So the question I would like to address today is the following one. So if we consider some quantum field theory, and if we take the take its non-relativistic limit, do we get in the end some non-relativistic quantum mechanical model? And by non-relativistic limit, I mean taking some initial state in which the energies of the particle are very close to their mass, which in turn implies that the relativistic dispersion relation reduced to the usual non-relativistic one, which in turn implies that the velocity of the particle is very small compared to that of light. And by non-relativistic quantum mechanics, I mean a many-body Schrödinger equation, such that the one which is written below in the two-body case, and where psi is the wave function describing the two electrons, for instance. And today, the quantum field theory I will consider is Yukawa's quantum field theory. It's some kind of simplified QED in which you have electrons and positrons that can interact together through the exchange of a massive boson. And so the Lagrangian corresponding to Yukawa's quantum field theory, it's simply the free Dirac Lagrangian plus the free Klein-Gordon Lagrangian plus some interaction term, where psi is a Dirac field, phi is the Klein-Gordon field, and g is the coupling constant. And in the rest of the talk, m will denote the real mass of the fermions, and mu will denote the mass of the boson. And it will also be assumed that mu is much smaller than m. In fact, the limit in which I'm interested in is the limit in which m goes to infinity, so the mass of the fermion. And so if we start from a... Sorry? Ah, boson, sorry. OK. Massive boson. Yeah, it should be boson. And so if we start from a state containing two low energy electrons, what we expect to recover is a two-body Schrödinger equation with a Yukawa potential, which reduces to the usual Coulomb potential if you take the limit in which mu goes to zero.
What one expects? I mean, has this ever been formally?
Yeah, it has been studied, but I can explain what has been done when I come there. Well, I think that the usual explanation that you find in quantum field theory textbook are not satisfying enough for this. Well, maybe I will tell more when I. If that's okay.
Maybe what he meant is that could you say just two words about your motivation of doing this before we follow the details?
Okay, but the motivation is just you have, well, basically.
That's what I meant. Oh, well, that's my question.
Yeah, well, there's a problem, and I never saw a clear answer to this question. And I just tried to study it and to see if I could come with something. Which was a bit new compared to what has been done in the literature. So basically, what I'm working on pilot wave theories, and well, maybe it's a bit too far. What we are interested in pilot wave theories is to consider the non-relativistic limit of these pilot wave theories, and to understand the non-relativistic limit of these pilot wave theories, you first have to understand the non-relativistic limit of the orthodox theory.
Thank you.
Okay. So now, if you want to obtain a non-relativistic Schrödinger equation, you could think that the best way to start is to work in the Schrödinger picture for quantum field theory, in which you have the following equation, where H y0 is the free Yukawa Hamiltonian, and hyi is the interaction Hamiltonian. And in order to study the non-relativistic limit, you would try to impose some condition on the initial state, upside t0. And this condition should be preserved by the evolution. And in fact, psi t should be an eigenstate of the electron number. Because then you can project on some position basis, and you could hope to recover a non-relativistic Schrödinger equation. Another question is how is the electron number defined? Well, you first look at the eigenstates of the free Hamiltonian, and then you see that they are obtained by applying creators C dagger, D dagger, and A dagger on the vacuum, and that C dagger creates an electron, D dagger creates a positron, and A dagger creates a boson. And then the electron number is defined by the following expression. So you just sum over all the spin components. You integrate over DQP, C dagger, SP, CSP. And here I will just anticipate a little bit on the rest of the talk. The problem is that this is in fact the bare electron number, and it's never conserved. For instance, if you think about the vacuum state, and if you start from some initial condition in which psi t0 is the bare vacuum state, then it will quickly evolve in a superposition of state containing an arbitrary number of pairs. So that's not the good way to proceed. So if we want real parameters, real mass parameters, what we have to look at is the S matrix. After all the renormalization ideas have been implemented. And so the idea would be to consider the S matrix from quantum field theory with two electrons in the initial state and two electrons in the out states. To take the limit in which the mass of the fermion goes to infinity, and then to compare to the S matrix that can be obtained from a non-relativistic quantum mechanical model, and to ask whether these two are the same. So the first step is to ask ourselves what's the S matrix that comes from a non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Then go to quantum field theory, take the limit, and then compare. But the problem is that it's impossible to compute the S matrix, but it would require computing all the Feynman diagrams. And now it's already clear that we will have to rely on some kind of heuristic arguments if we want to say something about the non-relativistic limit of quantum field theory.
When you say the limit as mass goes to infinity, is that different from taking the limit of the ratio of the masses to go to zero?
The limit of the ratio?
The bosonic mass to the fermionic mass?
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the bosonic mass.
So why is this not unphysical?
Sorry?
Why is that limit not unphysical?
Why would it be... Well, if you start from the is there a sh- Well, A, you can say that either P over M is much smaller than 1, or M goes to infinity, then for any P, P over M goes to infinity, goes to 1.
Yeah. That's a different limit from mass goes to infinity in general.
Can you just rescale dimension in by the square root of the mass of the fermions, and then in the Klein-Gordon action, there will be the ratio of the mass coming in?
But that's what I'm asking.
What?
Can you do that? I mean, otherwise, it seems as if, I mean, the mass of the electron is not infinite.
I don't see how you can.
Yeah.
The mass is. Can you? Yeah. I mean, I thought that the mass could be actually the dimensionalization of the landscape. Can you do that?
Yeah,
you could have m over mu somewhere, or mu over m, hanging up. No.
No, I don't think that you would get mu over m. Well, I know, I understand your point.
Doesn't matter. We can come back to it.
Yeah, actually, it's kind of a. Yeah, we thought maybe come back to this. So now the. The first task was to get the S matrix that comes from non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And in order to do so, you start from the two-body non-relativistic Schrödinger equation, where the coupling constant has been made explicit. And you rewrite this equation within the second quantization language. So you have your Schrödinger equation with the free non-relativistic Hamiltonian, plus the free non-relativistic interaction Hamiltonian, which is given by the following expression, where psi is just the psi dagger x is just the operator that creates an electron at position x, and A is related to spin components. And now, in order to get the DS matrix, you do just as in usual quantum field theory. So you have the following expression, where T is the time of the product, and HY NRY T is just the interaction Hamiltonian, but written in the interaction picture. So it means that the fields here would carry an extra label T. So they would be the free Heisenberg fields. And now if you apply Weak's theorem, then you can get the Feynman diagrams. And the situation is the following. The details of the calculation are not important, but the result is the following. So if you look at the situation in configuration space, so you have your two incoming electrons. At some time T1, they exchange a boson. And the exchange is instantaneous. And the propagator of the boson is just the V prime X1 minus Y1. And basically, they can do this n times. You sum over all these ladder diagrams for different number of ranks, and then you get the amplitude. And if you look at the situation in momentum space, well, the fermions carry energies and free momentum. You have three momentum conservation at each vertex. For each vertex, you have a factor yg. Now the energy is conserved after each rung of the ladder is crossed. So here you have that E1 plus E2 is equal to E1 prime plus E2 prime. You have that the electron propagator is given by the usual expression. And for the boson propagator, you have the Fourier transform of the of V point. So that's the well, the Feynman diagrams that comes from non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And now, before going to the S matrix that comes from quantum field theory, I need some ideas about renormalization. And so I will just remind the basic ideas of the renormalization program. So here you have the Lagrangian that corresponds to Yukawa's quantum field theory, the Klein-Gordon, the free Klein-Gordon Lagrangian, the free Dirac Lagrangian, and plus some interaction, the interaction term. And basically, this Lagrangian gives you Feynman rules. And then you can compute expressions such as the complete fermion propagator, which includes all radiative corrections. You can compute the complete boson propagator, and you can compute the complete vertex. And once this is done, you have to impose the renormalization constraints. And these constraints are the following. The first one is that the poles of the complete propagators should be at p squared equal to m squared. That's for the fermion. And p squared equal to mu squared, that's for the boson. So that means two constraints. And the two second ones are that the behavior of the complete propagators around the poles should simply be the free propagators, but with the real mass. So that means also two constraints. So up to now there are four constraints. And the last one is that the complete vertex at some renormalization point should be equal to y times g. And how is this renormalization point defined? Well, your complete vertex depends on two momenta, p1 and p2, because the last one is fixed by four momentum conservation. And a renormalization point is a point which fixes all the invariants on which this complete vertex can depend. So basically, if you try to do this, you would realize that all the objects that appear in the Lagrangian cannot be the real objects, but that they are just bare objects. So psi, phi, mu b, gb, and mb. So these five objects correspond to the five renormalization constraints that you have to impose. And now what you would like to do is to rewrite this Lagrangian in terms of real parameters plus some free parameters that you can tune in order to satisfy the renormalization constraints. And this is done in the following way. You introduce the real Lagrangian, which depends on five free parameters, z1, z2, z3, delta mu squared, and delta m. And mu r is the real mass of the boson, and mr is the real mass of the fermion, and gr is the real coupling constant. And so basically, if you do a little bit of the calculation of the well, in renormalization theory, what you would see is that 1 minus z1, 1 minus z2, and 1 minus z3. Delta mu squared, delta m, are just power series in GR, which starts at order 2. And then you can rewrite the real Lagrangian in terms of a zero order Lagrangian in GR plus a first order Lagrangian in GR, which is the interaction, or what you, the interaction, plus some counter terms which are there to make the amplitude finite. And now I would like to use some of these ideas from renormalization to define the two properties that I will use in the non-relativistic limit. And the first one is that you are free to choose the renormalization point for the complete vertex, and you can choose the renormalization point to be the on-shell renormalization point. So here, if you have the complete vertex, the on-shell renormalization point is defined in the following way. You take the complete vertex, and then you take you fix this the three invariant p1 squared. You take it to be n squared, p2 squared. You take it to be m squared 2, and for the boson, you take p3 squared to be equal to mu squared. And now the next property is a property about the behavior of the complete propagators for large space-time distances. And so here is the idea that I will try to motivate. So you consider a complete propagator px prime minus x. And if the space-time distance, so if the norm of the delta s squared is much greater than the Compton wavelength squared, I would like to justify that the four momentum contribution that will come to the, that will contribute to the complete propagators comes from the neighborhood of the poles. So basically they come from the EP, which are such that p squared minus p squared minus m squared is very small compared to the mass squared. And under this condition, you can replace the complete propagator by the free propagator with the real mass. So now I will try to justify the property number 2. Well, it's not really a proof, it's more some kind of indication towards the result. And so for the sake of, I won't say of simplicity. Let's consider delta x equal to 0 and t prime minus t, which is much greater than some scale lambda. And lambda, I do not know yet what it is. And if you take the expression for the complete propagator, then you get the following result. And here you see that you have an oscillatory function. And in the limit in which t prime minus t goes to infinity, so this function will oscillate very quickly. And it will wash out any contribution to the integral from this one, except where this one is also varying very quickly. And this one is varying very quickly around the pole because the complete propagator, well, the pole are at, so this one is varying very quickly around p squared equal to m squared. So this is somehow represented here. And so I'm saying that under this condition, you can assume that the contribution from the four momentum, from the four momenta, comes from the neighborhood of the pouch. And in fact, you can say since this space-time configuration space and momentum space are related by Fourier transform, you can say that the contribution will come from the EEP, which are such that E squared minus P squared minus M squared is much smaller than 1 over lambda squared. Well, you know, since the, well, now we know that the contribution comes from the neighborhood of the pole, but you also have one of the renormalization constraints that tells you that the complete propagators around the pole should be the free propagator with the real mass. And here we are, we are in the neighborhood of the pole, so we can just ignore the correction sigma-twiddle to the complete fermion propagator. And the last question is, how is this scale lambda defined? Well, if you want to extract some scale from this, you have either the Compton wavelength or the renormalization scale, which is the scale at which you can see the renormalization effects. And there is a classical argument to estimate this lambda. Well, you can consider a pair of particles that pop out from the vacuum, and you just say that the kinetic energy plus the potential should be equal to zero. So that means 2m minus e squared divided by r equal to zero, which gives you r equal to e squared over 2m. And if the coupling is small, this is also smaller than the Compton wavelength. So here, if I take the Compton wavelength, I don't make any error. I know I'm right whether it's the Compton wavelength or the renormalization scale. And in fact, there is a nice discussion of all this in Schreber's book. And basically, he says he's considering the complete fermion propagator for a boson. And he says, the behavior for small momenta for large time and spatial distance is dominated by the pole. So that that confirms what has been said. And he's also considering the behavior of this complete propagator in the limit in which the space-time distances are very small. That's equation 81. And he says, what equation 81 says is that for such an instantaneous experiment, the coupling has no time to take effect, and the quantum therefore propagates according to its bare mass. On the other hand, for large time intervals corresponding to realistic measurements, the propagator which determines the outcome is that with the physical observed mass of the particle. So basically, I first read Schreber and I tried to elaborate to get some justification for what he was saying. And so, in fact, the bare and the real rules that you get in quantum field theory, they are really two different aspects of the same thing. For instance, if you would use these bare rules, what you would get for the lowest order of the complete fermion propagator is just I divided by slash p minus mb, where mb is the bare mass. And on the other hand, if you use the real rules, what you get for the lowest order for the complete fermion propagator is y divided by slash p minus mr, which is the behavior of the complete propagator for large spacetime distances. So bare means small spacetime distances, and real rules mean large spacetime distances. Now I would consider the non-relativistic limit of the complete propagator, and I will take the limit m goes to infinity. And now in that limit, if I give any two spacetime point x and x prime, I know that they would correspond to a large spacetime distances because the delta f squared is much greater than one, that the Compton wavelength square, which goes to zero. And this means, since I'm in the large spacetime distance behavior of the complete propagator, that I can just replace it by the free propagator with the real mass. And it's also known that, the free Dirac propagator has the correct non-relativistic limit, which is I divided by E minus P squared over 2m.
As a question, or you could correct me if I've understood it wrong. This looks to me just like ordinary semi-classical approximation. If you have two sectors with a great discrepancy in the mass scale, like what you said here, one mass goes to infinity, then, for example, in basically you use the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, and what results is that you can treat all those as external legs. That's what you're doing here. For example, in quantum cosmology, you do that because the gravity sector is much more massive with the Planck scale compared to the matter scale, and so we treat gravity as a classical field, and in the quantum description, it's just an external name.
Okay.
Is that what you've done so far?
Well, we just read the exact.
It looks similar.
It looks similar?
Yeah.
Maybe it will get different.
No, it's exactly the same.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So I'm just. I'll see what you are developing.
Okay.
So now we have all the properties that we need, and we can go to quantum field theory, and then to compute the DS matrix from quantum field theory, and basically it gives rise to two different kinds of diagrams. And the first kind is the skeleton ladder diagrams. Well, they look like a ladder if you erase all the vertices corrections and all the propagator corrections. And on the other end, you have non-skeleton ladder diagrams that don't look like a ladder if you erase all propagators and vertices corrections. So now if you sum all these diagrams, all these skeleton ladder diagrams, you can write this sum in the following form. So you have a ladder with one rung, but where the vertices are the complete vertices, and where the boson propagator is the complete boson propagator, plus the two-rung ladder diagrams, the two-rung ladder diagram, where the vertices are the full vertices, the fermion propagator is the complete fermion propagator, and where the boson propagator is the complete boson propagator. So just to recall, when I mean complete, I mean all radiative corrections included. And the result I would like to show now is that if you take the limit for m goes to infinity, then these, they really look like ladder diagrams. And I will try to justify that the one that don't have whose skeleton is not a ladder, do not correspond to real spacetime processes when you consider the the limit in which m goes to infinity. So now let's consider the first case, so the skeleton ladder diagrams. And let's first consider the diagram with one rung. So here you have that the incoming electrons, so they have three momentum p over m, which is very small. Then you know that the outgoing electrons would also have three momentum p prime and let's say q prime, which are very small compared to the mass. And then you can obtain the four momentum for the boson propagator just from the fact that you have four momentum conservation at this vertex. And then you find that the four momentum k of the boson is given by this quantity. And if you compute, so the four momentum of the boson squared minus mu squared, you would see that it's much smaller than m squared, and which correspond to the neighborhood of the pole. And you know that we saw that the complete boson propagator can be replaced by a free propagator but with the real mass in the neighborhood of the pole. So it means that you can just forget about this one, about the correction, but take the real mass. And you could also see that K0 is much smaller than the norm of the three momentum K. And so K squared is approximately given by minus the norm of the three momentum k squared, and this gives you finally this propagator, which corresponds to an instantaneous interaction, just as in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, when you Fourier transform it back. And now all these particles are approximately on shell. But we have used the fact that the complete vertex at the on-shell renormalization point is just given by I times G, which means that we can replace the complete vertex by this factor I times G. And now let's consider the two-rung ladder diagram. And basically, the idea works the same for any number of rungs. So you have your two incoming electrons, with p, the norm of p small compared to m, the norm of q small compared to m. So you know that the outgoing electrons are also non-relativistic. But now, if you look at the situation in the configuration space, you know that these two points, the limit in which m goes to zero, would correspond to a large space-time distance, which means that you can assume that the fermion is approximately on shell. And so if the fermion has three momentum p1, then the energy is either plus or minus square root of m squared plus p1 squared plus some correction delta p1 zero, which has to be much, much smaller than m. But now, since we are in the neighborhood of the pole, we can replace the complete fermion propagator by a free fermion propagator, but with the real mass. And now what you can do is to obtain the four momentum of the boson, because there is a four momentum conservation at the complete vertex. and you get this quantity. And if you sum this quantity with the four momentum of the electrons that comes below, you come you arrive to another expression for the complete fermion propagator, which is E, and you can compare the two expressions. And if you compare the two expressions, you see that they can only match if the plus sign is selected in both cases, and if P1 is much smaller than M, and if Q1 is much smaller than M2. And then you can see, just as before, that the bosons are also approximately on shell, which means that you can replace the complete boson propagator by the free boson propagator with the real mass. And also, since all the particles are approximately on shell, you can replace the complete vertices by I times G. And so basically, the diagrams look just the same as the one that you can obtain from non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So now, what about the other diagrams? Well, I will give two examples, one at order 4 and one at order 6. And I will just assume that the four momentum of the incoming electrons have four momentum given by M0, because you can show that everything which is small compared to the mass doesn't matter in the arguments. So you have the same for the two outgoing electrons. Now, since these two points correspond to the large space-time distance separation, you can assume that the particle is approximately on shell. So the four momentum would be given by this quantity. And you can also see that the four momentum of the fermion below is given by the same quantity. But now, if you say that these two points correspond to a large space-time distances, you can see that P1 has to be very small compared to the mass, and you can see that the plus sign has to be selected. And then you can also show that the boson propagator, the K0 is much smaller than the norm of the three momentum K, and which gives you this expression for the boson propagator. And if you Fourier transform this expression, you see that this corresponds again to an instantaneous interaction. But for an instantaneous interaction, the boson could not cross. So that's why I'm saying that this, or it's some kind of your heuristic argument to say that this cannot contribute when M goes to infinity.
What's going on here for these diagrams?
Physically, it's that you have so it's a cross ladder diagram, and if you use the fact that this corresponds to large space time distance, well, you can end up with the result that the propagator has to be given by this expression. And now, if you take the Fourier transform of this expression, it corresponds to an instantaneous interaction. But for an instantaneous interaction, well, the boson could not cross. So I'm just saying that there is something illogical there.
I guess I don't see I don't understand the connection between the fact that it's instantaneous and they do not cross. I'm just seeing that.
No, how could they cross if the interaction is instantaneous?
this is another example of the six. And there, you, if you consider this diagram, you can show that the well, the energies of the bosons and also the norm of the three momentum has to be much smaller than the mass, the real mass of the electron. And then you end up with the fact that the, all these fermions should carry the same, approximately the same momentum p. But this cannot correspond to a space-time processes because they would have the same energies. They would all propagate into the future. But you cannot make a triangle if you don't have electron and positron. So that's the further.
So does that effectively shrink to a point, basically the triangle?
Does it shrink to a point? Well, no, because the shrink. I have to think about.
What is your claim just now? You think that this diagram is ruled out or what?
Yes.
Well, it becomes skeletal, it becomes important. Another way to phrase the a possible answer to the earlier question is that because of this instantaneous, we can't quite distinguish that crossing diagram because the contribution is comparable to this when it is instantaneous. It's not like you can replace it, but it's an order counting. The contributions. Okay. You don't see that contribution as being dominant anymore. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So basically, well, maybe I should say something about. Well,
so
when
so
you
what happens to this diagram, this last one? Is it that you throw it away? Does it vanish? Or does it become part of the ladder series? Because it shrinks to a, if it shrinks to a point. So
no, it wouldn't be.
So its contribution vanishes, or it's
well, I'm saying that the contribution vanishes because I cannot understand it at some space-time processes. Wait, was just
well, another way to look at it is that you don't have loop diagrams for the heavy mass set.
No, sorry,
you lose the loop contributions for the heavy set. That's
okay.
Why I said it shrinks to a point.
Okay.
Mm. And it's commensurate with what I said earlier that you're left with only external legs defined diagrams.
But I mean, you cannot just say that all these loop corrections. But what I was not satisfied with the usual treatment is that, well, basically they start from the ladder diagrams and they don't explain why. Let's say why you can just forget about all hiatic correction, why you can forget about these diagrams, but that's the point I was dissatisfied with the treatment. And now I will quickly outline another possible approach, which might be more rigorous. And for this approach, we have to go back to the Schrödinger picture. And if you, well, during the second of the slide, I say that the problem with the Schrödinger picture comes from the fact that you use bare particles. And for instance, if you start from the bare vacuum and if you solve the Schrödinger equation, you end up with a superposition of state containing an arbitrary a number of pairs. And so one way to circumvent this might be to start from the Dwest vacuum, which is the eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian with the lowest energy. And so now this dressed vacuum is still full of bare particles. But the question is, might it be empty
of some kind of dressed particles? And this seed result would correspond to a dressed particle annihilator. And in fact, here I'm just introducing an approach which is due to Greenberg and Schreber, which is dressed particle quantum field theory. And I will go to a few of its of the requirements of this theory. So you have the dressed vacuum, and you require indeed that it's annihilated by a dressed particle annihilator. If you create a dressed particle on top of the dressed vacuum, it has to be an eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian with the correct dispersion relation, and where M is now the real mass. And also, these dressed particle creators and annihilators should satisfy the same relation as the bare ones. But now it already looks good if you want to study the non-relativistic limit within this framework, because if you start from a state which contains a low energy dressed electron, you know that the state will remain a low energy dressed electron for any later time t. So it doesn't suffer from the drawback of the bare picture. And so now the question is how to enforce these three requirements. And these are enforced in the following way. You have to introduce a unitary operator which relates the bare and the dressed vacua. And this dressed operator, well, if you use it to get the unitary transform, then you get the dressed particle annihilator. Well, and if these two are related by a unitary transformation, you know that this will be satisfied. And you can also see that if these two are satisfied, then this one is satisfied. So the last one you have to worry about is the second one. And in order to study the second one, you start from the full Hamiltonian. So where A dagger J denotes on one of the bare creator. And then you can re-express these bare operators in terms of the dressed one by inverting this relation. And then the unitary U dagger can come in front of the Hamiltonian, and U can go at the inside just because you have product of fields. And finally, you get a new expression for your Hamiltonian, which is the Hamiltonian written in terms of these dressed particle operators. And in order to satisfy this relation, then this dressed Hamiltonian must take the following form. So it must look like the usual free Hamiltonian, except that you have now real masses and dressed particle creators and annihilators. And all the terms that you have, they should contain at least two annihilators if you want your one dressed particle state to remain a dressed particle state for any later time t. But what you don't want, on the other hand, is that the state containing two dress particles remain is an eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian, because otherwise you cannot describe a particle production and annihilation. And now, in this framework, in the non-relativistic limit, you would hope that a state containing two low energy dressed electrons remain a state containing two low energy dressed electrons for any little time t. So the question is how to find this U which relates the dressed particle operators and the bare ones. Well, here I'm just giving some ideas. In fact, in the literature, there is this Gell-Mann and Lowe theorem, which tells you that if you have an adiabatic coupling, and if you define the usual evolution operator, then that the bare vacuum and the dressed vacuum are related by this transformation. So it already looks interesting, because for the U that you want to connect to define your dressed particles, it has to satisfy. It has to relate the bare and the dressed vehicle. And in fact, this Gell-Mann and Lowe theorem is stronger in the sense that if you start from any eigenstate of H zero, and if you apply a similar transformation, then you end up with an eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian. And in particular, if you start from a state C dagger SP, so if you start from a bare electron, you know that it will be mapped to an eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian. And this is something that you want if the unitary operator coming from the Gell-Mann and Lowe theorem is indeed the one that relates the dressed and the bare particles operators. But the problem is that if you start now from a state containing two dressed particles, two bare particles, and if you apply the Gell-Mann and Lowe theorem on it, then you would also end up with an eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian. But this is something that you don't want. So, because if you apply this U on this state, you can show that this is equivalent to a state containing two dress particles. And it would mean that the state containing two dress particles is an eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian, which is not something that you want. So the only way to solve the problem here is that there might be some issue with the Gell-Mann and Lowe theorem in the case where H zero is degenerate. But then I saw that in textbook it's always assumed that the H zero is non-degenerate, but I never saw any extension of this theorem in the case where H zero is degenerate. So that's something I would be interested in seeing. But this is also another promising approach to study the non-relativistic limit.
Why this construction becomes problematic in the case of two particles?
Yeah. So basically, if you start from a state containing two bare electrons, and if you say that this U that comes from
Gell-Mann and Lowe theorem is indeed the U that you want to relate the address and the particle operator. Then you can do this, U, C dagger, U dagger, U, C, U dagger, U, zero. And then you end up with a state that contains two dress particles. But then you know that this state has to be an eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian, because the Gell-Mann and Lowe, what it does is that it takes an eigenstate of the free Hamiltonian and it sends you, it maps it into an eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian. But so any two dress particle state would be an eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian, and then you could not describe the particle production or annihilation with dress particles. So this is the end of my talk. So to summarize, I have tried to give a heuristic derivation of the fact that non-relativistic quantum mechanics comes out from quantum field theory if you take the limit in which m goes to infinity. So of course there are many things that should be made more rigorous in this derivation, but I don't know to which extent it might be done. And I also outline another possible approach, which is based on the concept of dress state. And then, in order to make any more progress, I would like to see some kind of generalization of the Gell-Mann and Lowe theorem in the case where the free Hamiltonian is degenerate. Thank you.
Can I just explore the last question just a little bit more? By degenerate, so let me turn that around. You're saying that the last thing you were describing, the C tilde, that's the dressed operator, right? Mm. And what you've written down there, you said that something is excluded because you cannot have particle production in those processes. Is that what you said?
Yes. Mm.
But my understanding is that the condition which allows you to go to a dress state, for example, cavity QED, people use that all the time because there's only one hole in the cavity and you can combine it with the atom. It becomes literally a dress atom. Mm-hmm. So the condition that people go to the dress state is such that it really is at the energy range where there's no hyperproduction processes, right? Once you do have those, you can dress each one by its quantum radiated correction and carry that kind of calculation, but no longer with this kind of dress state. Is that what you meant? It's really just a change of basis, right?
Yes. Mm.
So the process, the physical process, is independent of which basis you change. Of course, you choose a basis which is most apt for the description of a particular physical phenomena. It's based resting on the particle. I don't see that as a contradiction per se, meaning that it's really physical effects, just begs for some other description. Just give up the dress. Is that what you mean?
Well, but I would like to be able also to describe, let's say, processes in which particles are created and annihilated in terms of the interest.
But this notation, the last one you wrote there, that means that you have two dress particles now, right? And so are you wanting to not have that?
I want to have two dress electrons, but I would like also to well, let's say, to describe a process in which if I start with two ghost electrons which are sufficiently energetic, then that they might give rise to, say, four particles or something like that. And for this to, let's say, to happen, this cannot be an eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian.
Just to understand the whole thing better. I've been thinking in terms of semi-classical theory, which has the same description as you described. And I realized they are equivalent because you're not saying, when we say non-metric, usually we put a constraint on P, the momentum, right? But at the beginning, you said that it's equivalent to M goes to infinity.
Mm-hmm.
Which of course sometimes we need to change things that well look
it's a particle
so it's non metric state. Mm-hmm. It also requires classical features.
What I would be happy with is the, let's say if I could just impose only something on the initial state, and then I would impose, I would be happy if I can, if I have a proof in which all the initial momenta are very small compared to the mass. And if under this only condition I can derive the non-relativistic limit, then I will be more happy than with the first derivation, but for the moment I will not be able to attain this derivation. And basically what, I kind of follow what is done in quantum field theory, the usual treatment, and this is taking the limit in which m goes to infinity. So, in all the cases in which I can rely on this argument, I rely on it, and when I can't do anything else, I just switch back to.
You really answered the question that I raised earlier, because I think you're saying that if you could have a theory of a limit in which you're making dimensionless ratios of dimensional quantities become zero, that's preferable to the case where you take a dimensional quantity and make it go to infinity or something. Sometimes in the literature this is referred to a counterfactual limit. Counterfactual in the sense we don't live in a world in which the mass of the electron is infinite. And similarly, if you look at the best accounts, for example, of the limits in the Newtonian limit of general relativity, the Galilean limit of special relativity, the two classical limits of Maxwell's equations, all of these involve the so-called factual limits, where you're looking at ratios of dimensional quantities becoming small in the appropriate sense.
Yeah, I agree with you. I would be much more satisfied.
Fair enough, but I mean, you at least you're saying that you're getting the thing going. I mean, maybe in the future you could.
It's the same thing as my first comment. That is, when people do that, introducing the Born-Oppenheimer, basically, right? We do that a lot in momentum physics, all the way to quantum cosmology. So essentially, you're freezing one sector in this case, which is the infinite mass sector. But the real parameter is really the discrepancy ratio of the two sectors.
Thanks.
Any more questions? That's better. Thank you.